There's a new program to keep agricultural runoff out of the Ohio River, and it's already paying off.
My wife is actually catching fish out here with the kids. My grandpa used to do that. It's kind of cool to see the fish coming back into the area.
I'm Kara Holzapfel. This week on the Allegheny Front, our Headwater series continues with a look at how water trading could help farmers and the Ohio. And how might the region's agriculture benefit from its abundant water as the planet warms? Plus, a rapper is using sick beats to call out our dependence on fossil fuels. So be afraid, be very afraid, but we're not, despite what the scenario climate change, hip hop, and more coming up on the Allegheny Front. Stay with us. While there have been major reductions in childhood lead exposure over the last few decades, the Environmental Protection Agency says there's more to do. Keystone Crossroads' Margaret J. Krause reports the agency is considering how best to update a 25-year-old rule that regulates the nation's water systems.
The primary way that lead and copper enter drinking water is when it's leached out of old lead and copper pipes. To prevent that, the EPA's Lead and Copper Rule, or LCR, requires, among other things, that water treatment systems control the corrosiveness of water. However, the rule is structured in a way that allows providers to determine how best to do that. The EPA declined an interview, but in a statement said one of the key challenges for many systems is that the current rule requires them to change their treatment only after a public health problem is discovered. In a white paper released last week, the agency laid out its options for updating the rule. Changes could include point-of-use filters, increases in sampling requirements, and a plan for replacing old lead service lines. A new LCR is expected to be proposed next year. For Keystone Crossroads, I'm Margaret J. Krause.
Keystone Crossroads is a statewide public media collaboration focusing on Pennsylvania cities, their problems, and potential solutions. Now, more on water. Farm runoff. It's a major source of nutrients in the Ohio River watershed, and one group thinks it has an answer. But as the Allegheny Front's Julie Grant reports, some say this program is really just a pay-to-pollute scheme. It's part of our series, Headwaters, in partnership with West Virginia Public Broadcasting.
Come on, girls!
There are about 55 cows and 10 pigs on Kenny Merrick's farm in eastern Ohio. It sits on a hillside above a creek, which leads to the Tuscarawas River, a tributary of the Ohio River.
I grew up next door milking cows at my grandma's place when I got out of college and bought the farm and started farming shortly thereafter.
Today they sell grass-fed beef and pasture-raised pork direct to customers. They feed the animals and pile their manure by a barn at the top of the hill. It's muddy.
And this was literally, at times, almost waist-deep mud in spots.
The manure and mud used to wash down the hill, mucking up the stream, and Merrick didn't like it.
I needed to change something because we were losing the manure. Would wash off every time it rained. We didn't have a way of containing it, and we didn't have enough space for the cows.
Wash-off like this happens at farms all over the place, and it creates a serious pollution load. According to estimates, there are more than 250,000 farms in the Ohio River watershed. The Ohio is part of the larger Mississippi River basin, and farm runoff from the Mississippi is estimated to contribute the majority of nutrients, nitrogen and phosphorus, responsible for the dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico. And there's not much to stop it. Agricultural runoff is largely unregulated. Merrick wanted to stop it on his farm. He wanted to lay a large concrete slab for the cows and manure at the top of the hill, secure the hillside, and fence the cattle away from the stream. The price tag? $20,000.
That's enormous costs.
But Merrick heard about something called a water credit trading program. That's where industrial polluters, like power plants, buy credits to meet their pollution limits. And the money goes to farmers to pay for projects like his. Jessica Fox is an environmental scientist with EPRI, the Electric Power Research Institute, which runs the program.
We started looking into it to try to test out if water quality trading could be an effective mechanism to protect America's waters and to meet company bottom lines.
That's one reason water trading credit programs have been popping up around the country. It might be more cost-effective for industries to pay for farm projects that clean up nitrogen and phosphorus pollution in a waterway than it would be to control an equal amount of it at their industrial plants. In the Ohio River watershed, there are limits on nitrogen, but not on phosphorus pollution. As these nutrients are increasingly blamed for toxic algae blooms in the river, that's expected to change. Currently, in the state of Ohio, environmental regulators are pushing for new phosphorus limits in the river. And that could make those credits, which cost $10 for a pound of nitrogen or phosphorus, more appealing. Jessica Fox has worked for more than a decade on this water pollution marketplace between Ohio, Kentucky, and Indiana. It's the first multi-state program like this in the country.
The first thing outright is that there's rigorous science and verification to say that nutrient reductions that we claim we are achieving and turning into credits is real and valid.
She's getting at one of the major reasons water trading credit programs have been called pay-to-pollute schemes. Scott Edwards is a director with the advocacy group Food and Water Watch.
We're trading accountability for unaccountability.
His group investigated trading credits in the Ohio River and the Chesapeake Bay. He says these programs have made it impossible to track exact pollution loads from power plants.
A power plant has to measure its discharges at the end of the pipe, report those results. I can tell you, or I used to be able to tell you, exactly how much pollution was coming out of a power plant and into a stream.
But Edwards says there's no way to test exactly how much pollution is being reduced by a manure pad or buffer strip on a farm.
That's a guess of what that buffer could do. No one ever is going to measure whether those 1,000 pounds ever were stopped at that farm from entering into a waterway. There's no monitoring going on.
Environmental regulators in New York rejected a water credit trading program in their state for similar reasons, the difficulty of verifying results on farms. Jessica Fox at the Ohio River Project says they use well-established modeling to estimate pollution reduction on farms, and they work with state regulators to verify annually that the projects are being maintained.
I go out there, I go in the farm field, I can see the projects where there used to be all kinds of sediment and manure running right into the river. There is no question that nutrient recovery is happening.
She acknowledges that they can't measure pollution reduction on a farm the way they can at the end of a pipe, but says that doesn't mean there aren't as many benefits.
One of the underlying promises of water quality trading is that you get pollinator benefits, you're sequestering carbon, you're working with local landowners, that a lot of times actually reduces more nutrients than at your wastewater treatment plant or power plant.
To State Ohio beef producer Ken Merrick, since controlling the mud from his farm, he's seen the stream come back to life.
My wife is actually catching fish out here last summer with the kids. My grandpa used to do that. I never caught anything. It's kind of cool to see the fish coming back into the area.
This is one of 30 farms that have benefited from the water trading program. They say they've prevented more than 100,000 pounds of nitrogen and phosphorus from getting into the Ohio River. And they have a new round of funding available, this time for forestry projects like tree plantings. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Julie Grant in Columbiana County, Ohio.
What would make a rapper, a performer, take to the stage and raise a mic about climate change?
I think the urgency factor is the main one. I kind of feel like it's important that people know about it, think about it, talk about it, and deal with it.
Also, it's kind of fun.
Cause I make it hot. People say my rhymes are dope.
Coming up later on the Allegheny Front, the global warming beats with a burning message. Stay tuned. So while the Allegheny Front's Julie Grant was reporting on agriculture for our Headwaters series, which explores the future of the Ohio River's water resources, she wondered if farmers experiencing drought out west might move their operations east. Because we have abundant water, and climate models predict even more rain and warmer temperatures here. Here's one response she got by voicemail.
Hey, Julie. Will Roger at the American Farm Bureau. So I got your message. Don't quote me on this, but that's really one of the crazier ideas I've heard.
Okay, well, maybe that's not happening now, but to answer some of our questions about the future of agriculture in our region in this era of global warming, we talked to Armin Kamanian. He's a professor in the Department of Plant Science at Penn State and helped write the agriculture portion of the Pennsylvania Climate Impacts Assessment Update. How might rising temperatures due to global warming over the next decades influence agriculture here? What types of agriculture will do well and what types won't?
The change in temperature, you know, as an average, not as an extreme, what it does is open up a longer period of growth. Seasons for growing crops become longer. In theory, we could plant earlier and have mature crops even later in the season. So we will depend a little bit less on imports of some products because they could be produced here or be produced earlier. Now comes the caveat, right? The warming doesn't come just warming that makes every day a little nicer. It may come with in spells, you know, hot spells that make for extreme temperatures. That's not necessarily good for almost any crop. And an alternation of, you know, early in the season, what we call warm periods followed by a freeze that causes a damage.
I did read in the climate impacts assessments that hogs may be a product, that's not a crop, but that may be something that may move from the southeast where hog farms are big and move north into Pennsylvania, perhaps.
It is plausible that Pennsylvania becomes more suitable for animal production, right? Escaping the extreme heat in the south and getting into a more benevolent winter here. But as you can imagine, that comes with challenges, right? All the animal operations that concentrate grain and all the waste produced by the animals, you know, are a potential source of pollution as well. So on the one hand, we can welcome the increased economic activity. On the other hand, be very aware that it poses a potential environmental challenge if not done properly.
How can Pennsylvania or other water-rich regions capitalize on? We already have pretty abundant water most of the year, except for some drought in the summer. So how can we capitalize on that abundant water for agriculture in the future?
Well, I think the droughts that we have seen this year are a good example. Do we have to prepare slowly to have a better irrigation infrastructure to withstand potential droughts in a better way? So there is quite a bit of learning on the irrigation side to capitalize on the excess water or the abundant water. One thing is that we have a lot of water. The other is where does it go when it falls, right? It doesn't mean that because it falls, we can store it. That's a real challenge.
Because we're talking about more extreme weather, more extreme storms where a lot of rain might be falling at one time.
First is the fact that you can't store it. There is so much water that you can't store in the soil. And if it comes as a strong storm, it pushes runoff, erosion, and starts moving the nutrients towards the river, eventually causing some sort of pollution. It's not an uncontrollable thing, but it means that we need to adapt.
What can we learn from other regions that might already be taking advantage of their water resources?
Essentially, is that there are areas that have specialized, for instance, in the production of grapes, like parts of New York, and grape production is expanding in Pennsylvania as well, slowly but doing so. There are states, and you know, I'll go far west, like Washington State, in which they have seen an increase in the production of wines and vineyards. And why is that? In large part because production in California can become more challenging, and so naturally some producers start moving north. It's not that they move the entire operation, but they start exploring, and they find the places that are suitable for it. And then you have a town like Walla Walla in eastern Washington becoming a hub for grape and wine production, right? And for the east, I think the opportunity is the market. The market is close by, so I think savvy producers will take advantage of that.
Well, thank you so much for talking with me.
All right. Thank you, Kara. Thanks for the time.
Armin Kamanian is a professor in the Department of Plant Science at Penn State. There's more about how the region's agriculture might evolve as the climate changes and how that could impact when you get that first bite of local sweet corn this summer. That's at our website, AlleghenyFront.org. This is the Allegheny Front. I'm Carol Holsapple. Nearly a decade has passed since Pennsylvania's Marcellus Shale natural gas boom took off. But the state has only finalized new regulations for drillers recently. State Impact Pennsylvania's Marie Cusick reports how the process of creating them led to a bitter fight between environmentalists, the industry, and state regulators. And it's not over yet.
Scott Perry, who heads the Oil and Gas Office at the State Department of Environmental Protection, recently spoke to a room full of gas industry representatives at a conference in Pittsburgh.
Thank you.
He began by telling a story about a time he'd gotten into a fist fight with a friend in the 11th grade.
It was pretty lame, actually, because neither one of us actually wanted to fight the other one. And during the course of kind of like the wrestling around, I was like, you used to be my friend. Why are you doing this? And he's like, well, those guys said you said all these things about me and that you were going to kick my, you know.
And they'd only started fighting because two senior guys were egging them on.
I kind of feel like I'm in a bit of that same situation now, where I'm meeting with folks and on the side they're saying, Scott, you know, I really think that there's going to be some litigation involving these rules.
He spent the next hour or so politely asking the industry to please not sue the agency over the new regulations.
There's a better way of doing business than just fighting about it all the time.
Among other things, the new rules create tougher standards for waste management and replacing damaged water supplies. Another section gives DEP more oversight of well permit applications near public resources, such as parks. It's a provision Perry knew was a major sticking point for the industry.
Don't let the first call be to your lawyer.
That appeal was not successful. Within a week of them taking effect earlier this month, the trade group, the Marcellus Shale Coalition, filed a lawsuit, while another industry group already had one in the works. Here's Coalition President David Spiegelmeyer discussing the rules, known as Chapter 78A.
There are aspects of Chapter 78A that are onerous, costly, and they provide little environmental benefit from our perspective.
The regulations had been in the works for nearly 6 years, and discussions around them had prompted a knockdown, drag-out fight. For example, last year, DEP angered many in the industry when it changed the makeup of some drilling advisory panels. At a public meeting, an industry lobbyist invoked Al Pacino's performance in the movie Justice for All. You know the line.
You're out of order! The whole trial is out of order! They're out of order!
Yeah, he told the room the whole proceeding was out of order. And from there, things didn't get much better.
It was the closest thing to a public execution that I've ever attended.
State Senator Gene Yaw is the Republican chair of the Senate Environmental Resources and Energy Committee. He opposes the rules and was describing a February meeting at DEP where they were adopted. And here's what a House committee meeting sounded like last spring as the Democratic and Republican chairs argued over whether the rules should move forward.
I've been trying to get these regs passed.
Representative Vitale,
you're
out of order.
Well, you're referring to me. You're out of order, too.
The two GOP-led committees voted to reject the rules. Representative John Maher is the majority chair of the House panel. He criticized both the substance of the rulemaking and the process DEP had followed.
These are not mere technicalities. I will remind you that it was a Republican initiative that set forth to review and update regulation of the gas patch.
But it didn't end there. The saga continued as the regulations then went before the state's Independent Regulatory Review Commission,
calling to order the meeting,
which held a seven-hour-long meeting last spring and heard from people like Joe Thompson of Devonian Resources, who argued the regulations would cripple business.
The spirit of the law has been ignored, and our already reeling industry stands to suffer a death blow.
Despite similar pleas, the commission approved the rules, and it looked like a win for state regulators. There was a lot of internal high-fiving at DEP. But then came another twist.
Well, a few storm clouds have been circling the state capitol. Environmental Protection Secretary John Quigley resigned last week after firing off an offensive email that caused outrage.
In the email, Quigley sharply criticized environmental groups for failing to push back against legislative attacks on the regulations.
The email is as salty as fracking fluids. Quigley writes, "Where the F-word expletive were you people yesterday?"
When word of the note surfaced, Quigley was out of a job. Not long after that, Governor Tom Wolf's administration announced a deal with the Republican-led legislature. It was June, the annual budget crunch time. Half the regulations would be tossed out, those dealing with the conventional oil and gas industry, which drills shallower wells. The Marcellus Shale drilling regulations were allowed to move forward. Representative Greg Vitale, the Democratic chair of the House Environmental Resources and Energy Committee, was not impressed.
I don't think the people remaining in Wolf's top echelon really prioritize the environment.
The intense political battle over the regulations is pretty unprecedented. That's according to Kurt Klepkowski with DEP's oil and gas program. He says it's unlike anything he's seen in his nearly 23-year career at the agency.
It's just the reality that we operate in, and we try to be analytical, we try to be professional, we try to divorce ourselves from those political processes as much as possible.
That might not be very possible. The department is right now trying to fend off the lawsuits and reboot the regulations for the conventional industry that were killed during budget negotiations. It will likely take another 2 years. Marie Cusick, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
We're going out today on a musical note, or beat. Baba Brinkman is a Canadian rapper who's recently gotten a lot of press over his latest album and one-man show. That's because Brinkman's throwing down rhymes all about climate change. I recently talked to him from his home in New York. You've rapped about the Canterbury Tales and evolution, and your latest is the Rap Guide to Climate Chaos. And in one of the songs you say you could rap about anything, and climate change is about as, quote, unsexy a topic as anything I could imagine. So why a whole album devoted to climate change?
You mean besides the fact that it's an urgent existential crisis that humanity must tackle for us to continue developing as a civilization? I think the urgency factor is the main one. I kind of feel like it's important that people know about it, think about it, talk about it, and deal with it. But also, I think it's fascinating, the way people respond to it. And there's something about the human psychology around avoidance of the subject that I'm intrigued by. You know, I kind of joke about that in the record, that this is as unsexy a topic as anything I could imagine. And I love a good challenge.
You're talking about lots of different aspects of climate change throughout the whole album. The IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, they assess climate change risks worldwide. And they're the title of one of your songs, and that has to be a first, I think, in the music world. Let's hear a little bit of that.
Chaos, refugee, stress, disease, extinction, disaster, IPCC. So be afraid, be very afraid, but we're not, despite what the scenarios say. And the effect of talking about it is visible yawning and occasionally changing our behavior microscopically.
And, throughout the song, I kind of leave it on the table, like assuming the audience is going to know what IPCC stands for. And then at one point I go, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change formed in 1988 to get the science straight. And that's the sort of like I'm defining the term. I do kind of like how the effect of like pronouncing it as being all sinister, but it's actually like this bureaucratic government UN body. It's not exactly like a horror show, but some of the signals about various scenarios that could play out under business as usual actually do look like a horror show. So.
Yeah, wars, famine, disease. So is that song like a wake-up call for people? What's the strategy for how you approach different aspects of climate change in the album? Because there is a lot of levity, but there also is some pretty dire stuff in there.
Yeah, I think I was trying to walk a tightrope between the doom and gloom disaster scenarios and the sort of bright side perspective that, you know, technology will solve it and human ingenuity and we're going to get through this together and don't worry about it. Because I think too much optimism and too much pessimism end up leading to complicity and people sort of throwing their hands up. And, you know, if it's optimistic, great, I don't have to do anything, enjoy my life. And if it's pessimistic, what's the point? Whatever we do won't matter because we're too far gone. So, you know, I was trying to, I guess, sort of mark out the extremes. And also, you'll probably have noticed listening to the album that not every song is entirely earnest. A lot of them are ironic or tongue-in-cheek. And I kind of hope that people are going to pick up on some of the subtleties and nuances and realize I'm playing with personas there.
For instance, if I write a rhyme trying to describe climate change and it's hot so it catches on, someone's gonna fly me someplace to perform it. And the appeal of that is enormous. It's not an option for me to turn down work for global warming, cause I make it hot.
Make it
people
hot.
Say my rhymes are dope.
So how do you want people to receive your music, this album, listen to it at the gym, you know, take some kind of action as a result of what they're hearing? Who's the audience?
I think people who believe that they already know and care about climate change, but haven't necessarily thought it through to its necessary conclusions. I think people that are concerned about climate change, but don't support government legislated carbon pricing scenarios, you know, that's who I was hoping to reach. People who think that climate change is a hoax have already signed up to the idea that there's a massive international conspiracy. But there's a lot of people that, oh yeah, climate change is a problem, we should do something about that. You know, I bought a Prius last year, so I'm good. You know, so I kind of wanted to shock the sort of nominal progressive mentality with the record and make people realize that it's, you know, it's going to have to be more significant of a response than just a few token consumer changes.
Joseph Fourier was a Frenchman, a physicist and a mathematician. He discovered the fact that the atmosphere acts like a blanket for heat retention. The greenhouse effect first described in 1824.
You've described your raps as peer-reviewed, like academic journals. Did you really run your lyrics by climate scientists?
Yes, absolutely. And it was a climate scientist who first suggested that I do this record. His name is Stephen Picar, and he saw me do a show, I guess about 5 years ago, called The Rap Guide to Evolution, and he said, we need one of those for climate science. Do you think you could do that? So it took me a couple of years to get it together. But yeah, while I'm writing it, I'm reaching out to experts in the field, sending them copies of my lyrics and my script, and trying to get them to come back with any feedback or corrections or suggestions about how to tell the story as completely as possible and accurately as possible from a science perspective. Like, part of this gives me the ability to stand on a stage while I'm performing this stuff and be like, this is mainstream science I'm talking here. You know, you could take it up with me, or you could take it up with the IPCC. you know, I'm just basically representing the orthodox view. And surprisingly, it's pretty hardcore sometimes.
Would you take us out with a rhyme or a verse?
All right. Here's verse 2 from Fossil Fuel Ballers. Look at how we live in gangsta compared to horse and buggy days, cranking up the air conditioner on muggy days, not freezing to death in the winter. If energy consumption is a sin, I'm a sinner. Life is good, it's better than it used to be. Let the good times roll, fossil fuels are cheap. That's how we stay hella major. Prosperity is the bomb, player hater. And yet we somehow need to find a way to connect prosperity to lower emissions rather than higher emissions as it's been in the past. But that's my little statement of where we're at right now.
Well, Baba Brinkman, thank you so much for talking with me.
All right. My pleasure. Thank you.
Try to keep it positive. Try to keep it positive.
Baba Brinkman is a rapper and performer, and there's more about his album, The Rap Guide to Climate Chaos, at our website, AlleghenyFront.org. Thanks for listening to this week's show. Kathy Naur is the executive producer of The Allegheny Front. I'm Carol Holsoppel.
Support for The Allegheny Front comes from the Heinz Endowments, the Pittsburgh Foundation, the Foundation for Pennsylvania Watersheds, the Laurel Foundation, the Catherine Mavis McKenna Foundation, PNC Charitable Trusts, and the Benedum Foundation. The Richard King Mellon Foundation supports our coverage of energy and conservation. State Impact Pennsylvania is a collaboration between public radio stations WITF in Harrisburg and WHYY in Philadelphia, covering the Commonwealth's energy economy.